Thank you, Rebecca, and thanks to everyone on the call for joining us today. I am Dana Fisher. I'm Legislative Director and Counsel at the National Low Income Housing Coalition, and I'm joined here today by Dave Ramler from the National Housing Law Project and Catherine Bender from the National Law Center on Homeless and Poverty. I'm going to start the presentation with a brief overview of the context in which the Act was created and the legislative history. Then Dave will talk about the Act itself, and Catherine will discuss the efforts, the ongoing efforts around implementation, and then some of the relation, the way the federal law relates to state and local laws. In terms of the how we got the Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act, or the PTFA, it became pretty apparent as the foreclosure crisis grew that significant numbers of families impacted by foreclosures were tenants, and that these tenants had, who had no responsibility for the foreclosure, also had no rights once the foreclosure was completed. The a study by the National Low Income Housing Coalition early in 2008 demonstrated that about 20% of those impacted by foreclosure are renters. And because state foreclosure processes generally terminated any tenancy that came after the creation of the mortgage, once the foreclosure occurred, tenants could be summarily evicted from the properties in most states. The a study that was co-authored by the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty and the National Low Income Housing Coalition cataloged the lack of protections for tenants in all states. This study is called Without Just Cause. And so with these two pieces of kind of background information and with the experience that members of Congress were seeing in their own districts as the foreclosure crisis played out, Congress began to try to grapple with the issue of how to provide a set of uniform protections for tenants in foreclosed properties. The, these efforts began in 2007 with some language that Chairman Frank worked on. There were independent standalone bills introduced in the 110th Congress, both in the House and the Senate, to provide protections for tenants in foreclosed properties. And then provisions protecting tenants in limited circumstances were included in both the TARP bill and the Neighborhood Stabilization Program as when it was enacted in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. But up until first part of 2009, none of these provisions had produced a uniform nationwide protection for tenants. The so when S-896 began to be considered by the Senate in the first part of 2009, in the spring of 2009, that's the Helping Families Save Their Homeowners Act, the Senator Kerry offered an amendment to that bill, which was to become the Protecting Tenants in Foreclosure Act. He, Senator Kerry, had been the sponsor of a standalone piece of legislation in the 110th Congress, and so he was able to build a very strong base of support for the adoption of this amendment when it came to the Senate floor. But because of the fact that the Protecting for Tenants in Foreclosure Act ultimately just showed up as an amendment on a bill that had not gone through and did not go through committee, there is no committee report, or and then S-896 did not go through a conference committee process, so there's no conference committee report. So in terms of general legislative history, what you have to rely on is the floor statements that were made during the adoption of the provision on the Senate side when it came up. In the interest of time, I'm not going to talk about all the details of the floor statements. They can generally be found in the Congressional Record for May 5th and 6th of 2009. But and they're predominantly at Senator Kerry, Senator Dodd, Senator Gillibrand from New York, as well as some comments in opposition by Senator Coburn and Senator Shelby. But generally, the takeaways from the legislative history is that Congress knew what it was doing. It knew and intended to write a uniform set of protections for all tenants in all states. It understood that it was overriding less protective laws than existed in most states, and that it was maintaining and protecting any more protective laws that states could have. These interpretations were recently reinforced by a floor statement that was made by Senator Dodd and Senator Kerry on August 6th, where they reiterated the purposes of the bill and the fact that it was to apply broadly and be sort of with the broadest interpretation of protections that you can have. So if you want to know more about the legislative history, we have some information on our website, www.nlihc.org, under a webinar that Catherine, Dave, and I did a little earlier this spring. It's a webinar link in the center of the page. So today.
All right, I'm David Ramler with the National Housing Law Project, and I'm going to talk about the substance of the bill. For those of you who would like to find this bill online, although it is on the website that that Dana just spoke about, you can type in your search engine Thomas, as in Thomas Jefferson, .loc, as in Library of Congress, and you'll see at the home page you can look at public law numbers. The public law number for this is 111-22. It's fairly simple to get into that, and then you just look for the version which was passed by both houses. The first operative section, Section 702 of the bill, says that the law covers in all foreclosures on federally related mortgage loans or on any dwelling or residential real property. Now, to a certain degree, that's the distinction that some people have some question about. Why, if you say all dwellings on residential real property, or does federally related mortgage loan limit it? And the answer is, the federally related mortgage loan covers all 1-4 unit residential dwellings on which there is some sort of loan secured by the dwelling, wherein the lender is any bank that is regulated by any federal institution and any number of other private lenders, primarily private lenders who do over $1 million of lending per year. You'll find those definitions at Title 12, United States Code, Section 2602B. That's also set forth in the statute. And you'll find the regulations governing that at Title 24, Code of Federal Regulations, 3500.2. And I don't think we have time to get into the details of that, but basically this covers 99.8% of all mortgages in the country. Now, what the law says is that if a person or a family is a tenant, a bona fide tenant, in a property covered by such a mortgage, and the property goes to foreclosure, the successor in interest takes the property subject to the lease and subject to that tenancy. Now, the successor in interest, in legal terms, is whoever acquires a legal title through the foreclosure process, which is equivalent to that of the mortgagor, the person or entity which defaulted on the mortgage. So in some states, there is a thing called a right of redemption after the sheriff's sale or foreclosure auction or whatever the process is in your state. Someone can take title, but if the defaulted mortgagor, the borrower, comes back within a certain period of time, be it 6 weeks or 6 months or a year, and pays off the debt, they get the property back under the mortgage. That's called a right of redemption. Now, in many states, there is no actual successor in interest until after that right of redemption has expired, but in some states, there is. So there are things within the law which are clearly governed by state law. This is an umbrella act. It's not written in the kind of detail you'd see a state statute written in, because it has to cover at least 52 jurisdictions. So, successor in interest is whoever comes up with a clear legal title after the foreclosure process. That person or entity must accept the existing tenant as a tenant. if that tenant has a lease which is called at will, that is, under normal circumstances could be terminated and the tenant could be removed at the will of the landlord, or if it's a 30-day lease or a 60-day lease, or if it's a lease which originally was for a year or 2 years or 5 years but has only 90 days or less remaining, then those families must be allowed by the successor in interest to stay in the property under their lease, and both parties abiding by the terms of that lease, for at least 90 days, or until that successor in interest gives the family at least 90 days notice to vacate. If the family has a lease which extends for more than 90 days into the future, then they are allowed to stay for the remainder of the lease and can be removed at the end of that lease only if the new owner has given the family the proper 90 days notice to vacate. Now, the notice must comply with state law, and every state has different requirements for what that notice should be. The federal law does not create requirements for the notice. It simply uses the word notice, the phrase notice to vacate. There is a provision in Section 702 which requires that the tenancy be a bona fide tenancy. Bona fide in the law means fair and honest, sort of. The exclusions from bona fide tenancy are if the mortgagor, that is the lender, the purchaser of the original property, or the child, spouse, or parent of the mortgagor is the tenant. So you can't have a lease within a tight family of parent, child, or spouse, and that be qualified, because there was some thought maybe people would just do this to try and avoid the other implications of a foreclosure. However, about 2 days after this law was passed, I got a call from someone who was the sibling, the sister of the mortgagor, and the answer is the law doesn't say sibling. So the details of any, this is a law, all the words matter. Another exclusion is that if the tenant is paying substantially less than fair market rent, another attempt to exclude sweetheart deals. However, if they pay substantially less because their rent is subsidized, for instance, in a Section 8 voucher, then they can still be a bona fide tenant. If they pay their fair share under that federal or state or local housing assistance law. And the other provision in the law says that the tenancy must be the result of an arm's length transaction, which is sort of shorthand, I think, for bona fide. It has to be, it can't be an insider sweetheart deal intended to otherwise manipulate the situation in an improper way. Section 702 finally then says that this law, as Dana said, does not preempt or take away or override any state or local landlord, tenant, or contract laws which provide longer periods of notice or other additional protections for tenants. Now, there's a second section of the operative law, which is 703. Section 703 governs Section 8 tenancies, that is, vouchers. There are, I don't know how many million vouchers in the country. 2 million, I'm told. All right, so It governs families who have rental assistance under the Housing Section 8 Voucher Program. And it says that the new owner, the successor in interest at foreclosure, takes subject to the lease which the tenant had with the former owner and the housing assistance payments contract which the former owner had with the administering agency. Normally, that would be a public housing authority, public housing agency. In some cases, it would be some other state or local agency which administers Section 8 programs. Now, but in terms of Section 8, it only covers vouchers. It does not cover what are called project-based Section 8s, although because of the nature of project-based Section 8 contracts, they do not terminate at foreclosure, even if HUD is the entity foreclosing. And if you if anybody has particular interest in that, the National Housing Law Project has created a memorandum on that. It's a one-page piece. It's pretty short, but it does explain the area and footnote the authority for that. So Section 703 adds on to and supplements Section 702. 702, which governs any foreclosure on a federally related mortgage loan or any dwelling or residential real property, governs virtually everyone in the country, as we've said. Section 703 of the bill creates changes in the Section 8 lease because the federal statute says the following things must be in a Section 8 lease. So Section 703 primarily modifies the provision of the federal statute which governs Section 8 leases. How are we on time?
We've got about 10 minutes left.
Okay. Good. We're going to move on. Thank you very much.
Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm Catherine Bendor, Legal Director at the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. Very pleased to have an opportunity to speak with you today. In the few minutes left on the call, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the interaction of these new federal protections with state law and their importance, and also efforts that our three organizations have been engaging in to get the word out about the new protections and to ensure that this very important law is implemented and enforced around the country. First, with respect to state law, our office, the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, we're a nonprofit based in D.C., and we engage in policy advocacy, impact litigation, and public education to prevent and end homelessness. We started looking into the foreclosure issue basically out of concern that it was leading to increased homelessness, and reports we were hearing around the country suggested that was correct. And when we started looking into the situation of renters, we were really struck by the fact that they had, in virtually all states, they had hardly any rights in the foreclosure context, and Dana Fisher alluded to this before. It was really very striking, especially since many of these renters were fully in following their lease in good standing and had no responsibility whatsoever, no control over what was happening with their landlord's finances. So these renters, especially low-income folks, people need time to get together a new security deposit, et cetera, find another place to go, find a new place in the first place, were risking being thrown out on the street. And fortunately, legislators recognized that and passed this new law. Dana mentioned a report that the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty and the National Low-Income Coalition, Housing Coalition published last February, which is called Without Just Cause. And that was sort of the result of this research. It's a 50-state review of the rights of tenants in foreclosure, or lack thereof, as we put it, before this federal law was passed. And it looked at foreclosure procedures and laws governing evictions in this context in the 50 states. And I mention that because it's still a very valuable resource for understanding the foreclosure process and what rights folks have under state law. And that report's available on our website, the www.nlchp.org, and also the Low Income Housing Coalition's website, www.nlihc.org. So our organizations and others work to help bring about this new federal legislation and are very pleased that it passed. It was passed on May 20th, or signed by President Obama on May 20th, and went into effect immediately. And I want to emphasize three things in particular about the interplay with state law. First, I want to emphasize how much better these protections are than what exists under state law in virtually every state. With respect to the first of the sort of new protections, the right to 90 days notice, this is a drastic difference from what existed before in virtually every state. Some states had 30 days notice, some states had 60, some didn't specify, some had as little as 3 days notice before people could be out on the street. It's very important to realize how much better this is and how much even this additional amount of time can make a difference to folks needing to shuffle and quickly find a new place to go. Second, with respect to maintaining the lease and the right to maintain a lease under the new federal protections, obviously except in the case where the new owner is going to occupy the premises as a primary residence. In only two states prior to these laws, District of Columbia and New Jersey, did folks have a right to maintain their lease after foreclosure. Foreclosure was not a cause for eviction in those states. Now, as David laid out for you, the federal protections obviously apply in all the states. So this is a huge difference. And it's important that consumers, their advocates, and relevant players in the lending industry and the housing field generally know about the new protections and honor them. I said the lending industry. As I've been learning, I should say the lending, servicing, and eviction industry in reality. The second point I want to make about the interplay with state law is that state law still applies to the numerous aspects of this whole process and situation that aren't directly dealt with by the new law. The new law lays out these specific protections, but it doesn't give all the sort of background information about if you have to give notice, but how do you give notice, things like that. Other points, if they're not dealt with directly by the federal legislation, you should look to state law to figure out how to carry those out. So it's still very important to understand what state law provides in this area. Third, the new law, as David mentioned, does not negate any greater protections or additional protections provided by state or local law. It provides these new protections, which, as I mentioned, are better than in most states or virtually all states. But it says if there's anything better in state law or local law, that applies too. So effectively, whichever is better, the tenants in the best situation they can be in that interplay. So it's very important that folks be aware of what state law is currently, so they can make sure that these federal protections are honored, but also anything the tenant is entitled to under state law is also afforded to them. And with respect to that and the fact that With Just Cause was published before this new law, I want to mention that we're going to be updating it and producing a supplement in the wake of the new federal law, and we're planning to cover in that new state legislative developments since February that may provide additional tenant protections. So wanted to make folks aware of that. With respect to getting the word out, our offices are taking sort of a two-pronged approach. First, we're trying to get the word out to renters and their advocates directly and through others who interact with them in the process. Second, we're trying to get the word out to banks and others in the lending industry to make sure they're aware that the new law exists and make sure they know that they need to follow it. On the first point, our three offices are very busy making presentations, conducting trainings, circulating announcements and newsletters and on listservs, and producing materials. And I encourage you to look at our three websites, or the websites of our three organizations, to find some of those materials, including sample letters that David was very active in creating, letters that tenants can use to send their landlords, and other materials in a similar vein that can be very useful as models. We also did a webinar that was widely attended in June about the new law, and you can find both the PowerPoint slides and the audio portions of the webinar on our three websites. In addition to work that our office is doing on the consumer side to get the word out, there are lots of local groups and attorney general's offices, state attorney general's offices, some courts and others who are working to get guidance out at the local level. And HUD has a notice in the Federal Register, volume 74-30106, the June 24th, 2009 Federal Register, that describes this law and emphasizes the responsibilities placed on the immediate successors and interest in these foreclosure processes. So that's potentially useful as well. People are starting to find out. We're hearing a lot of reports and hearing from advocates and attorneys that have questions and are actively working to make sure these laws are followed. Many more still don't know about it and need to find out. In addition to the work we're doing and will continue to do, we encourage you to get the word out to all your networks to the greatest extent possible to make sure everyone far and wide knows about these protections and they're implemented. On the lender side, we're also doing some education. We hosted the webinar I mentioned in June, and we're planning another one, which is likely to take place on September 22nd. And the first one was geared toward advocates and attorneys representing the tenants. This one will be more broad, and we're actively encouraging representatives of the lending community to participate. We're also working actively with the banking regulatory agencies and with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and we're starting to work with the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission as well, which would play a role with respect to lenders that are not banks. And the bank regulators, we're getting a generally good response, and we're sort of happy to announce, as some of you may know, that the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, which regulates the national banks, just put out a bulletin on August 13th, and you can find that on the OCC's website. It's listed right on the homepage when you call it up, and that basically informs the banks. It's directed to the CEOs of all the national banks and all the management officials and examining personnel at the OCC. It informs them about the law and basically says that the OCC is going to evaluate bank compliance with this law in their supervisory process, which is very helpful. Shortly before that, on July 30th, the Federal Reserve Board issued a similar letter informing the Federal Reserve banks and its consumer departments about this law and instructing bank examiners and actually providing specific guidance to evaluate compliance with this law in their examination process. So we're waiting for hopefully similar responses from FDIC and possibly the Office of Thrift Supervision, and as I mentioned, we're working with FTC as well. We're also likely to be approaching some of the major banks. We're starting to do this to bring concerns to their attention. And in that vein, I wanted to encourage you or mention to you two ways you can report problems with lenders and failures to comply with the law. One is on the OCC website, they've set up a reporting process, and they're interested in hearing from people about who are aware of banks or lenders that they regulate or in general that are not complying with the law. So we encourage you to look into that. The FTC is also interested in receiving complaints, and while they're not likely to do active enforcement, they will be referring complaints as appropriate. So they have a complaint process as well available on their website. And we've set up a special email account. We're very interested in hearing about problems that we can actively approach these organizations and help make sure that problems are corrected, especially with respect to lenders that hold mortgages for a large number of properties. So I want to give you our new email address. It's PTFA Matters, Protecting Tenants Foreclosure Act Matters, ptfamatters@gmail.com. We encourage you to write in if you know about problems, and please try to put the name of the lender in the subject line. That would be very helpful. So I hope that gives you a little bit of overview of the interplay with state law and the efforts we're engaging in, and we encourage other folks, again, to be active in spreading the word and to let us know if you have suggestions or comments about how to do that to the greatest extent possible. Thanks.